I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Design is ascendant, and today we will celebrate it by talking with Dr. Larry Thompson, president of Ringling School of Art and Design. He's staging the Sarasota International Design Summit October 9th through 11th, and we'll find out about his plans today on Smart City. Also with us is Dilip Soman, marketing professor at the Rotman School of Management in Toronto, who is using his skills to influence better public behavior. Plus, we'll find out about which cities are the angriest in the opinion of Men's Health magazine. That's all today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Larry Thompson is president of Ringling School of Art and Design. Prior to coming to Ringling, Larry was the first president and CEO of the Flint Cultural Center, located in Flint, Michigan. He also served for 4 years as the director and CEO for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum in Cleveland, Ohio. Ringling is hosting the Sarasota International Design Summit in Sarasota, Florida, October 9th through 11th. Larry, there are a number of major design conferences staged around the nation. What makes this one different?
Basically, what's happening at the Sarasota International Design Summit that we're holding in Sarasota, Florida in October is to bring together a whole cadre of people from the business world, from the design world, from nonprofits, from hospitals, from cities, and so forth to discuss the whole arena of how design differentiates and gives meaning to people in all of those kinds of environments. Many of the design conferences that I've been to tend to be designers talking to designers. And this is one of trying to break out from that and have designers talking, but also talking with the leaders in business and nonprofit organizations, et cetera.
Do you find business leaders and leaders of nonprofit organizations open now to that conversation?
They're starting to be. This is a fairly new concept for a number of different industries. In the business world, it's probably a little more accepted than others because they're understanding after seeing what's happened at places like Target or the designs of different things, even Anheuser-Busch with their beer bottles and so on and so forth, how it really differentiates products. So there's some more acceptance, at least at a larger level, in terms of many of the corporations. With some of the other industries in the nonprofit sector and in even some of the cities, I think it's still a pretty new kind of concept. But that's why we want to bring people here for them to really learn about that and why that's important.
Do you think the public sector understands the potential impact of design in its fullness, or do they still think about it as the signage?
That's a great question, and I think the answer to that is that they think about it primarily in a signage if they think about it at all. It's one of those things that because it is so pervasive, you don't really stop to think about it. If you start to give examples, it's amazing how people go, well, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the best example I can give you is like automobiles, okay? Why do you buy a certain automobile? They all run now. They all function well. And certainly there are some considerations of price and safety. But the reality is you buy it because you like the way it looks and the way it feels. And that's what design is all about, is how it looks and how it feels. So I guess it was Robert Lutz who at one time with General Motors described automobiles as, it's not really even being in the transportation business anymore. It's really about moving sculptures because that's what they are. And then they also happen to provide transportation. So just simple examples like that, or going into a Starbucks and the feeling you get when you go into a Starbucks of it not being, you know, you're not rushed. It's not a place that's so huge that it's impersonal, and it's not so tiny that you feel like you can't sit down. But it gives you a feeling of community, and that's really what they were. That's what it was designed to do, and that's what design. Those kinds of design principles are all about. So, It's all around us, but people don't oftentimes think about it.
You cited the example of the automobile, and it's a good one. And yet, I think about the public realm, and there's some things that don't have that functionality, that where the functionality could be improved substantially. That's also a fertile area for design, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. That's what the whole creative element is about. And certainly designers are looking at not only improving the look of something, but also looking at how it works and how it can work even more effectively. There's no question that if they can make, you know, the better mousetrap, if you will, then that is certainly going to be something that's going to differentiate the product. If they can make a better mousetrap and one that really looks cool, that'll be even better.
You make a good point. Sarasota is part of the Tampa Bay region, and I know that transportation, public transportation, is very much on the agenda there. You don't have much of a public transportation system at this point. Is the Ringling School involved in that conversation at all? Do you have a role in that conversation?
We have somewhat of a role in that conversation, because we want the people to really, who are engaged in this thing, to think about design thinking, to use, if you will, design principles as they are thinking about some of these larger issues. What tends to happen, and it just is, I guess it's just the nature of the beast, is when you get into a conversation like that about public transportation that is just, you know, it's just overwhelming almost, it all becomes about the engineering. And there's no question that engineering is absolutely, absolutely critical and very, very important. But it needs to be the engineers working with the other creative people in terms of how do you get people to, once you have a system, how do you get them to use it? I mean, that's one of the problems we face here in Sarasota. We have at least a bus transportation system, but nobody uses it. So, you know, the role here of designers and the role of Ringling School is to bring together those concepts of business and functionality with principles of art and design. And that's really what's needed in today's world.
Larry, let's talk again about the Sarasota International Design Summit coming up October 9th through 11th at the Ritz-Carlton in Sarasota. You have a very big lineup of speakers. Who stands out for you?
There are a couple that I think are really that at least stand out to me, but there are going to be others that stand out to others depending upon where their interests lie. I'm very anxious to hear John Remington from Target Corporation, because he's the person who really came up with the idea to, if you will, differentiate Target from other big box retailers, if you will, by using the concept of let's get a named designer to design some of the products that we're selling at Target, give it a whole different feel and image. And it has been hugely successful for Target. When you think about where they were 5 or 6 years ago and where they are today, it is amazing. And they've been probably one of the most successful in doing that. I mean, who would ever think you'd get Michael Graves to design a toilet brush, okay? So I'm anxious to hear his whole concept about that. Another one that I think is really interesting, because we have, for example, is one of our major academic programs here, an interior design program that is really world-renowned. And so the person who is the director of design and operations for the Mayo Clinic is coming. Now, when you think of a hospital, you don't really think much about design. At least I don't. But what he was able to do is working with Steelcase was to really try to transform the patient experience and to make it a more satisfactory experience for the patient as they're going through, you know, a difficult time involving healthcare. And to me, that's very, very revolutionary for the healthcare industry.
You do have a great list of speakers and a very unusual one based on my travels to similar conferences. What do you hope the impact will be of this design summit on the Ringling School of Art and Design?
Well, one of the things that we at Ringling School are about doing is we see ourselves as this, just so everyone knows, we're a 4-year college offering the Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in a number of different disciplines involving the visual arts. One of the reasons for doing this is because we see as our mission not only educating the visual thinkers and designers and, you know, people who are going to be that creative element for the 21st century. So that's the internal piece of what we do. But we also feel that it's really important to educate people about basically how they see art and design, how it impacts them, how we are going through it's basically a renaissance, if you will, in terms of the whole thing with art and design right now and its importance to our economy. You know, you read the headlines about outsourcing and doing this and doing that. Well, one of the things you can't outsource is creativity and the creative element. And you can't outsource that kind of innovation. And if you even think about our country, what has made us so strong are a lot of things. But one of them is we move from one age to another, if you will, from the agricultural age to the industrial age to the knowledge age, and now some would say the conceptual age. We move in through these ages by reinventing ourselves. That's what we do. And it's all that innovation and that creativity that I think spawns from the kind of freedom that we have to be able to do that.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Larry Thompson. He is president of Ringling School of Art and Design. Tell me about the kinds of problems your students are trying to solve.
Well, it depends upon which day and which event you want to talk about. They're facing many of the problems that any college student, of course, would. But they're an interesting group because, first of all, they're incredibly focused. They're very professional. They're doing their passion at the same time that they're being educated. So it's a real gift. So they're not like many college students who are trying to find themselves. They know that they want to go into this world and into that world of art and design, and they're committed to it, and they really want to be the best that they can be. I think one of the interesting problems that we tend to face is often our students are pretty traditionally aged. Certainly not all of them, but many of them are, you know, the 18 to 25-year-old. One of the issues that they face, quite frankly, is the feeling of their parents who really question why in the world is my son or daughter going to an art school.
Mm-hmm.
And that moves to that whole myth that existed in our generation as we were coming of age during that period of the myth of the starving artist. And the parents have not seen how much the world has changed and how many employment opportunities there are today in this visual, in this creative universe. You know, it's one of those things where if they're not going to become a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, oh my, what did I do wrong so that they're going to become an artist? Well, reality is these artists are coming out from our institution, for example, with major, major jobs and are heavily recruited by all the major motion picture industry, creative elements, graphic design firms, you know, interior design firms, et cetera. But that myth of the starving artist still exists, and we need to debunk it.
Are there continuing effects on Sarasota and the Tampa Bay region due to the presence of Ringling, in your opinion?
I certainly would hope so. I think we are more and more trying to really be seen as a major community and regional resource. In the past, we have been like many other institutions of higher education, I think, where, you know, you tend to become very isolated. The connection usually is with the football team. Well, mm-hmm. You know, guess what? We don't have a football team. Okay. But you know what? If we did, our uniforms would be really neat looking. But anyway, so we're now in the process of really reaching out because all institutions of higher education are really major economic development engines for the community. What I think many people hadn't realized in an art and design school is how important the students are in terms of economic impact, but more importantly, what they are if they stay in this area for that whole creative element.
Well, it makes sense that you would focus first on your students and the impact that they can have on the community. As an institution, Larry, do you reach out to the community in specific ways to say, let us be a resource? We were talking about your role in the transit discussion in the region earlier. Are there other ways that you look out in the landscape and you say, this is going to be an issue for this region? We need to be at the table.
Yes, there are. And I actually, one of the interesting components of that is going back to our earlier discussion about the summit. Let me give you an example. How this whole idea came about is because we were, I'm on the Economic Development Corporation Board. And one of the things that we did in our whole strategic planning of that was to look at different industry clusters.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of, you know, trying to do an amorphous thing, we started looking at focusing and getting people involved from different areas. So you have, you know, medical and biomedical, whatever, and then you've got, you know, manufacturing, and you've got some other clusters. But one of them is the creative cluster. And then as when that cluster was created, it was like, okay, what things can we do to help show how Sarasota is one of those communities that is trying to embrace the creative class? And so one of them was, let's showcase a bit of Sarasota by, what if we held a summit that deals with this issue of innovation and design, which the Ringling School is the one who's putting it on, and that's to basically help, you know, showcase the community and showcase what is it that happens in assisting the economic development of the area. So the summit is actually a great example, I think, of how we are partnering with the community to really help solve an economic development issue for them.
You're talking about, in some ways, what the institution is doing for the community. How can the community support an institution like yours, other than the obvious way, which is money, which is good?
Money is good, and, you know, that's the unfortunate part sometimes about being a president of a college, is that's how you tend to spend most of your time, is out raising money, of course. And so that's a very, very important element. But I think in terms of the support of the school in other ways, it really is one of recognizing the value of the school. It's not just something you sort of drive by. Students are interested in art, you know, and they have all kinds of interesting perceptions about what those students might look like. So one of the things I think they can do is embrace us as a true community resource and work with us as we are doing things to assist not only our students, but then also to assist the greater community.
Tampa Bay has this interesting clash of very conservative social views and sort of an anything goes group as well. I mean, you see that manifested in some interesting ways. Where does an art school fit into that picture?
I guess the way I would describe it is that we fit, in reality, we fit very well into that equation. And I'm going to explain that because you wouldn't think that. You would think an art school would be part of the laissez-faire, you know, side of things. And certainly there's a whole component of that because we're also very interested in freedom of expression and making certain that, you know, people are free to express their views through their art and so on and so forth. But there's a whole other component, which is even shown in this design summit in a subtle way, is we really know there is a gap. There is really almost a major schism between the business world that tends to be more conservative and the art and design world. We are about bridging that gap. So we actually have our feet in both sides of those areas. And it is one of helping our students learn what are the facts, what are the situations to help them learn about business and the business of art and design. And it's one of helping business people to learn about the importance of the creative process and how that works. So we really are becoming, and really I think we haven't succeeded yet, of course, because it's a pretty big mission, but it really is to bridge that gap between the business world and the art world, because they need each other. They really need each other.
Is it still possible, Larry, to register for the Design Summit?
Yes, it's still possible to register. I will tell you, we're getting a incredible amount of interest, and we've just, like, in the last week or so, we have really, really increased the registrations. People have really coming in. But there's still room, and we don't want it to be one of these huge conferences. We're trying to limit it to 300, 350 people at most, so that people can walk away with some major substance, some time to spend with the speakers and learn from them in the workshops, instead of it being, you know, one of these conferences you go to with, you know, a couple thousand people.
Larry, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure, Carol.
Dr. Larry Thompson is president of Ringling School of Art and Design. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Dilip Soman about the surprising ways people can be influenced to change their public behavior. And Matt Marion from Men's Health is with us to give us the list of America's angriest cities. Plus, Otis White will tell us why corporate headquarters are returning to the city of New York. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, corporate headquarters are moving back to New York, but they aren't necessarily bringing a lot of employees with them into the city. Is that good news for New York or bad news?
It's good news. Surprisingly good news. First of all, sort of the background on this. In the 1970s and 80s, the story from New York was all the corporations fleeing from there. That is, moving out to either the suburbs or moving away from the city. You may remember Pepsi and General Electric moved to the suburbs. American Airlines left for the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And there was a lot of hand-wringing about, well, we just don't need a city for all these corporate headquarters. We can scatter them around. Well, something's happened, because in the last 15 years, according to federal census statistics, the number of corporate, subsidiary, or regional headquarters in New York has more than doubled, from 274 in 1990 to over 600 today. But there are some differences. These companies that are coming to New York today, the ones that are locating there, don't tend to bring huge numbers of employees in the headquarters themselves. Very often, the staff part of it, the HR people, all of those kind of folks, are still out in the suburbs or in some other city, but the CEO and a handful of folks will move to New York. So the good question you ask is, well, is this good for New York that they're coming and they're bringing 50 people as opposed to 500? And the answer is still good, because of the reason they're coming. And the reason they're coming is because they want to be around people who provide high-level services or give them good advice. And those are the folks that are increasingly drawing the corporations there. So you want a law firm that can provide a full range of international law, you might have to go to New York. You want the very best thinking about marketing and advertising, you might have to go to New York. So even though the corporations themselves are not bringing huge numbers of people, although I have to point out the people they do bring are paid pretty well, they're still inspiring great growth in this what's called producer services economy of New York. And that is enriching New York. So that's the great news. There's almost no downside about this to New York.
It's interesting. This is Saskia Sassen's theory of global cities in action, isn't it?
It is, indeed.
And it's also interesting to think that geographic density, or being close to your peers or those who can provide you services, being in the same city still matters.
Yeah, you know, for this kind of cooperative business where great minds have to come together and think, it's very hard to do this online. It still takes people sitting down in the same room and brainstorming together.
And who wants to travel?
There you are.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Dilip Soman is Chorus Chair in Communication Strategy and Professor of Marketing at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. A world-renowned researcher in behavioral economics and marketing, Dilip focuses on understanding managerial and consumer psychology, customer management, consumer savings, spending, and investment behavior, and data-driven marketing. He joined Rotman after teaching at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. Dilip, describe your work at the Center for Integrative Thinking. First, tell me what integrative thinking is.
What we've been doing here at the Rotman School is actually pushing an agenda for business education where we're making the claim that it's not so much knowing models and knowing your finance and marketing that actually makes a successful leader, but it is understanding the psychology of people, understanding the thinking process that people use, understanding knowledge of sort of cognitive and social psychology to build your own models, to actually create your own view of the world, to help people resolve clashes in their own models that actually drive success in business. So what we've done at the Center for Integrative Thinking here is we've built an ambitious agenda of not just education in terms of the MBA program, where we've actually completely revamped the way in which we teach our MBA program here, but we've also started on a fairly ambitious research program trying to understand what makes some of the good leaders excellent integrative thinkers, what is the cognitive skill that's involved, what are actually the consequences of being integrative in their thinking approach. And just as an example, the kinds of research that we've been doing that I've mentioned to you before, where there's always a claim made that is sort of implicitly echoed all throughout the business world, which is if you want to be successful in business, if you want to be profitable, well, you've got to sacrifice something else, so you can't be environmentally friendly, for example, and be profitable. And we said, no, that's not exactly the case. You can actually integrate both of those two seemingly different objectives into a solid business plan. And that's what we've been trying to do here at the Center for Integrative Thinking. Now, my own research in this area has been twofold. My training is in the field of behavioral economics, and I got that training at the University of Chicago in the Center for Decision Research. And it's a field that sort of talks about business behavior and economic behavior and what role psychology plays in that behavior. So what we try and do is to combine psychology into models of business or models of economics to come up with a much more enriched view of how agents behave, and these agents could include consumers, they could include managers, they could include firms as a whole. And what I've been doing here at the Rotman School over the past couple of years is to take some of those tools and apply them to encouraging good, positive social behavior. So we've been doing research both in the classroom and outside in terms of how do we get people to, for example, save more money? How do we get them to be to conserve more energy, to be more health conscious, to take public transit, and so on and so forth? And it's a research program that's in its infancy in terms of the amount of work we've actually done. There's a lot more to be done than what we've done, but the early results are amazingly positive, and we've all been extremely enthusiastic about what we've found so far.
And when you say positive, give me an example of what outcomes you've been seeing.
Okay, so what we've tried to do is to try and devise simple communication, for example, or simple programs to encourage people to save more money. Now, one simple example that I love to give of a program like this is something that we experimented with in the lab, and we said, well, if you think about how people make savings decisions, what they do is they compare the benefit of the extra unit of consumption versus putting that extra unit in their bank. And let's say we're talking about somebody that's already got $500,000 in their bank accounts. They are looking at spending $100 on, I don't know, maybe a little dress or whatever else, a fancy dinner. And the question they're asking is, well, what's the difference between $500,000 and $500,000 plus $100? And it doesn't seem like a whole lot versus the immediate benefits of that wonderful dinner that they've planned. So what we say is, well, suppose we can get people to actually segregate those savings, that the $100 actually takes a life of its own, we believe that people become a lot more aware of the value of the $100, and they would then be much more likely to save it. So what we do is a simple program where if you think about a bank account, a bank statement, what normally happens is if you log into your bank account, the first number you get up on the screen is your cumulative balance, which actually includes everything you've got. And we said, well, suppose we don't do that. Suppose we hide that number and instead project the monthly saving that they've actually incurred to date so far this month or this year. What effect would that have on savings behavior? And what we found, what it does is that it actually gets people to focus more on the $100. The money seems to take a much larger than life value than if, in fact, it was bundled into their cumulative savings so far. And we find that people are much more willing to actually set aside the $100 and curtail their spendings. We've done similar stuff with things like energy conservation. And again, all of the results we've had so far are based on surveys. They're based on experiments in the lab. We would love to do experiments in the field, but I think at this stage our goal is to actually collect a lot of intention data just to make sure that we have all of our ducks lined up. But we've done experiments where we've actually taken energy consumption and instead of framing it as kilowatt hours, we've framed it as dollars, and suddenly people become a lot more sensitive to how much they're actually spending. We've done the segregation story that I just talked to you about money. We've done that with energy conservation. We find, for example, that people, they don't switch off air conditioning as much as they should for the simple reason that it's very silent in terms of consumption. So could we make it noisy consumption? Could we make it salient consumption? So we've tried things like, having meters that actually beep every now and then once you've consumed above a certain budget and so on and so forth. Then the same thing with driving behavior and taking public transit instead of driving. Again, the point is a lot of people sort of look at, when they drive, they look at the cost of petrol, the cost of gas as their out-of-pocket cost, but they do not factor in things like depreciation and parking and tolls and so on and so forth. So what we've done is we've devised a little handy sliding meter which actually tells people exactly how much they're spending per kilometer or mile that they drive. That includes all of the depreciation and taxes and so on and so forth. And a lot of people are surprised. And the moment they actually get something like that in front of them, we find that they report at least that they're going to be much less likely to drive and take public transit instead.
You described a similar piece of research to me that I thought was quite fascinating, and it was all designed to encourage people to be greener, if you will, in their daily habits. You described a project that you did where you actually counted the number of bags of garbage that people disposed of and gave them feedback on that.
What's common across some of these behaviors is that people just don't get enough feedback about how much they've consumed or spent or so on and so forth. And we looked at the garbage project and we said, well, listen, we interviewed a few people and said, are you even aware of how many bags of garbage you generate? And a lot of people were in the ballpark, but they really sort of had no clue about how much they were generating. And so we said, well, suppose we simply give people feedback on how much they're generating. And so what we did was we monitored a few folks, and this was with their consent. And at the end of the month, we simply told them how many bags of garbage that they had generated. We framed that information in a bunch of different ways. We said, well, listen, we know based on the ministry's projection of how much it costs them to deal with garbage, we're going to project a per bag cost of garbage, and that came down to like, I don't know, $2.20. And we said, so therefore what you've just done in this past month is you've generated $70 worth of garbage that in fact is going to cost the government $70 to take care of. And again, that simple piece of feedback gave them the incentive to be a little bit more vigilant about their behaviors in terms of generating trash. The other strategy we've tried is to actually think about social comparisons. So we said, well, let's imagine we were able to compute the average generation of garbage for a given neighborhood. We could compute the average consumption of electricity for a given neighborhood. Suppose we mailed people statements that were a function, whose color was a function of whether they were above the average or below the average. What sort of effect would that feedback have? And again, we find social comparison has a huge, huge impact on people's, again, in this case, reported behaviors. So you print out for them a statement which is bright red if, in fact, they have consumed much more than the neighborhood or generated a lot more trash than the average of the neighborhood, and a green statement if, in fact, they have done a lot better than their neighbors. They will report significantly greater likelihood of consuming less.
You've said that solutions to changing behavior generally fall into four categories. Tell me what those are.
Well, the simplest one, obviously, is education. It simply makes the claim that a lot of people are just not aware of the consequences of some of their behaviors. I think education helps a lot, but I think at the same time, it's not the only solution, because most people are rational enough that they know the consequences of generating too much trash or consuming too much electricity or not saving enough for retirement. I think we all know that. I think the big challenge is that when it comes time to make a decision about, let's say, setting aside money versus spending it, we fall prey to temptation, because something that's in front of us becomes a lot more salient. It's a fairly robust behavioral bias that people are myopic when it comes to consumption. And so we said, well, let's think about a different strategy for influencing people's behaviors. One other strategy might be to actually fight fire with fire. So we said, well, listen, suppose we know that people are being biased, could we, in fact, introduce another bias that helps us cancel out the first bias? Let's say we know that most of the people we interviewed are aware of the fact that they should be replacing their old furnaces and air conditioning with more energy efficient appliances. They all know that, but we ask them, why don't you do it? And they say, you know what, when it comes down to it, there's a financial outlay. I've got to actually buy the damn thing, and then I've got to actually hire someone to install it for me. There's all of these costs that are associated with it. The benefits are diffuse. I'm not even sure when I'm going to get them. And so we said, well, suppose we had a program in place where we actually fast forwarded the benefits. So we went to these households, and suppose we told them that you not only have to not pay for this appliance, but actually we'll pay you to have this appliance installed. But in exchange, what we're going to do is we're going to charge you $5 a month for the next several years to actually cover the cost of the appliance. What would happen? And we find, based on our research, again, this is based on interviews, that people are going to be much more likely to say yes in these cases, because what we've done simply is we've taken that future benefit, which was fuzzy and spread out over many different months, we've bundled that into one cash benefit that is immediate. We've taken the cost, which was immediate and salient, and we've actually now spread that over several months and made it fuzzy and delayed. And holding the financial consequences actually identical, what we can do is, of course, change consumer behavior. So the second strategy has to do with sort of thinking about what bias drives people's reluctance to engage in green behaviors, and then finding an opposite bias to actually cancel out the effect of the first bias. The third sort of general strategy has to do with providing feedback, and we talked about the example of garbage a few minutes ago. Again, I think the general principle is that a lot of people make these small, simple decisions one by one in terms of generating the extra bag of garbage, in terms of buying the extra cup of coffee. But if you gave them feedback at the end of the month in terms of how many cups of coffee they've consumed, a lot of people would be shocked, because these are all sort of simple behaviors that happen one-off. We don't have a good mechanism for keeping track of them. So feedback works well as a good strategy. And then, of course, social comparison, where what you do is you take people and you say, well, listen, you've done better than or worse than the average. And again, we find that social comparison is a very, very strong motivator that gets people to align their behaviors a lot with what other people are doing. So those are the four broad strategies. I mean, we could actually get into more specifics, but I think that would be probably premature at this point in time. But all of our solutions fall into one of those four broad categories.
Dilip, do you think that urban leaders are aware of this kind of thinking, these kinds of strategies that would help them get done what they're trying to get done?
You know what? I'm actually optimistic. The quick answer is no, I don't think they're that aware as they should be, but there's a good reason, and the good reason is that there hasn't been a lot of work in this area till, you know, very, very recently. So, for example, there's a behavioral economist at Chicago called Richard Thaler. And what he did was he introduced a program which is very similar to some of the stuff that I've talked about, called Save More Tomorrow. He calls it the SMART program, S-M-A-R-T. And what he does in that program is he goes to organizations and sells them a savings plan that, in fact, they can offer to their employees. Again, the idea is pretty simple. He says, well, listen, nobody wants to save money today, because if you go to employees and say you should be setting aside more money, they'll find a million excuses for why they can't save more than what they're saving. And he says, but at the same time, we know that people are pretty okay making commitments for the future. So he goes to employees and says, don't save anything else today more than what you're saving, but save more tomorrow. And what do we mean by that? He says, every time you get a salary raise, you should commit to setting aside half of that raise into your savings. And people are very happy to commit to doing that. A lot of people who make commitments never actually change their commitment. And that has worked wonderfully well. So he's actually implemented this plan in a couple of organizations. It's been about a year and a half or 2 years. And it's only now that he's begun to demonstrate that, in fact, this plan ends up with savings rates that are significantly higher than your traditional plans, than, in fact, even cases where you have a financial planner coming in to help employees. And so it's only now that I think people are beginning to set up and take notice of the power of behavior in economics. I think the traditional thinking used to be that it's all about incentives. It's all about monetary incentives. So, for example, with energy conservation, people would say, well, you know what, increase the prices of electricity and people will consume less. And it turns out it doesn't work a whole lot that way because, you know, think about a family that's spending $42 a month on electricity. You increase prices 10%, well, now they're spending $45 or $46. You know, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter a whole lot. It's now that people are beginning to notice that behavior and behavior techniques actually count.
It's fascinating work that seems to have a lot of application and promise for urban leaders who are trying to do everything from reduce the cost of providing urban services to reducing congestion to reducing crime. And I would think that all of those are problems that could benefit from this approach.
I absolutely agree. I think it's got a lot of legs. The power in the approach is the fact that it ultimately relies on the simple psychology of your end customer, your end target. And the good news is that while we know that people are people and everybody is a different individual, that there are some very, very simple standard principles that replicate across a large set of population groups. So we know, for example, that people are in general risk averse, people are in general loss averse, and so on and so forth. So these are very simple principles. And all that it takes is to go in, understand the target customer or the target person whose behavior you're trying to change really, really well, and then design a simple behavioral program. I think it's as straightforward as that. It's not, you know, it does take a while in terms of getting a project up and running, but I think the principles are very simple yet very powerful.
Dilip, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Dilip Soman is professor of marketing at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. You're listening to Smart City. Matt Marion from Men's Health is with us to give us the list of America's angriest cities. Matt, in the view of Men's Health, what constitutes an angry city?
Well, we looked at several different factors, including high blood pressure, because, you know, that's certainly a physical sign that there are probably some anger issues going on there, as well as rates of aggravated assaults from the FBI, workplace deaths from assaults and other violence, and also we often express aggressiveness in cars. So road congestion, traffic congestion certainly can cause the anger, as well as, you know, speeding to when you finally break free of that traffic to express it. So we took all that data together and came up with our rankings.
Were you looking at the blood pressure of men only?
Yeah, in this case, we did just look at men. However, we think that, you know, when you combine those results with the other criteria I just mentioned, I think you get a pretty good snapshot of the cities as a whole. So I don't think it's exclusive of women.
It's an interesting set of indicators. I understand the speeding ticket indicator because you included that, correct? The number of speeding tickets. But why traffic congestion?
Well, the idea being that there may be perhaps, you know, nothing that gets, you know, more people universally peeved than to sit in traffic. And, you know, the more opportunities there are for you to, you know, be stuck looking at, you know, another person's bumper and marking your progress in hours instead of minutes, then, you know, we think the more likely people would be to be angry and let it affect the rest of their day, even if it's a morning commute.
You didn't include domestic violence or abuse. Why not?
Well, we try to basically look at things kind of separate, perhaps, from specific psychological, say, issues. You know, for example, with domestic violence, you know, I think that's a specific problem, and it's an important one. However, I think it speaks more to a certain unique mindset, let's say, or, you know, mental problem, rather than what might be affecting the city as a whole. So that's really why we excluded that.
Let me ask you this. Did you consider including the popularity of talk radio in a market?
You know, can you believe it? I did not. I did not.
Well,
however,
maybe you should add that to your list next year.
Well, as someone who does listen to talk radio, I know that there are times when I certainly do get a little bit angry.
So tell me which cities topped your list of angriest cities.
Okay, in terms of actually being the angriest, Orlando, Florida came in at the bottom of our list at number 100, followed by St. Petersburg, Detroit, Baltimore, Nashville, and Wilmington at 95.
Now, these are the angry. So if you're at the bottom of the list, you're an angry city.
Yes.
Okay. You know, looking at that list, there are some cities that just make no sense to me. Nashville, St. Petersburg, Orlando. Were you surprised?
A little bit. But, you know, you think about it, there are some reasons that come to mind. One being, especially in the southern cities, certainly the heat, you know, can make a difference. Orlando in particular, one thing we thought about, God, you know, you're living in a tourist trap, basically, which is great on the one hand because it, you know, keeps people employed and you know, brings money into the area, but it's basically having a lot of people traipse in and out of your backyard, and you know, that might wear thin after a while.
And certainly St. Petersburg and Nashville don't have the number of tourists that Orlando do, but they're both known as tourist cities also.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have people coming from, you know, all over the country to these places, and they have their own unique cultures and traditions and so forth that I think people don't necessarily understand and may not respect.
Which cities were the least angry?
Least angry, I'll start with the number one least angry was Manchester, New Hampshire, followed by Bangor, Maine, Fargo, North Dakota, Corpus Christi, Texas, and then Portland, Oregon.
What do you make of that list?
Well, what I found interesting is when you go a little bit further down and you get to number six, you get Burlington, Vermont in there. So really in the top six, you have three New England cities, which, you know, to me kind of does make some sense. My experience in being in different states in New England, as well as anecdotal things I've heard, you know, it's fairly bucolic, laid back. I mean, people do typically in the Northeast go there to get away. So I can't say I'm surprised at that. The other areas, I think, could also be just a simple the culture of more rural living, say in Fargo, for example, that might lead to just people being calmer and a bit more sedate.
Portland, Oregon seems to top every list of good characteristics for cities to have. Tell me where the other West Coast cities were, Seattle, L.A., San Francisco, San Jose, San Diego. Do you see those on your list?
Yeah, I can tell you right away which California cities finished near the top. Fresno and Fremont were 18th and 19th, and they typically finish pretty high in the rankings that we do as well. San Jose was 26th. Seattle, you know, that's a good one because that does typically come near the top of most lists. This time, you know, I don't believe it finished quite as high. It was number 58. That's kind of interesting, especially when you consider Portland's high finish.
What about L.A. and San Francisco?
L.A. actually came in, I think it was pretty much in the middle. Yeah, it was 65th. So, and that actually finished a little bit worse than New York. And I think a number of people I've spoken to were surprised that New York didn't finish, you know, lower in the rankings. But my explanation for that is that I think, you know, the people that get most angry and frustrated in New York are the people that don't actually live in the city. They're the commuters and so forth. The residents, I think, you know, people, they know it's the trade-off you have to make for, you know, having such a great city.
And Matt, where do you live?
I live in suburban New Jersey, so I don't fall into any of these towns, but I certainly can, you know, relate to what I just said about New York City. I love to go in there. I love to visit it, but heck, I wouldn't want to live there. Maybe I would adjust, but, you know, the traffic and the, you know, congestion and the people on top of each other, I think, would make me pretty mad.
Matt, thanks for sharing with us the list of angriest cities by Men's Health Magazine.
Thanks, Carol.
Matt Marion is the articles editor at Men's Health Magazine. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth, croons Frank Sinatra in his classic Young at Heart? This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith examines why older workers remaining active may improve their own quality of life and the bottom line.
A decade-long study on aging, sponsored by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, found that on average, only one-third of how people age is genetic. Two-thirds is attributable to environmental and lifestyle factors. The ways in which people choose to live determines the quality and character of how they age. Staying engaged in one's life is a big part of how well one ages, which means that older people today are likely to live forever. Older people are remaining on the job. From 2000 to 2005, the percentage of 65-plus workers increased from 12.5% of all workers to 14.5%. Boomers are likely to push this percentage even higher. Every survey of boomers finds the vast majority planning on working in retirement. AARP surveys in 1998 and 2003 found 80 and 79% respectively. In a 2005 Merrill Lynch survey, it was 76%. In a 1999 Scudder Kemper Investment Survey, it was 74%. And in a 2005 survey conducted by the Rutgers Center for Workforce Development, it was 66%. If they're not working for others, older people today are working for themselves. The rates of entrepreneurial activity from 1996 to 2005 were consistently higher among 55 to 64-year-olds than among other age groups. And in recent years, the largest absolute increases in the rates of entrepreneurial activity across all age groups have been among 65-plus-year-olds. Working longer not only keeps older people going, it keeps the economy going as well. A 2003 survey by consulting firm Towers Perrin found that employees 50 years of age and older are much more motivated than younger employees to, quote-unquote, exceed expectations on the job. Employee engagement is crucial to business performance. As the Towers Perrin analysis showed, companies with higher employee engagement outperform their competitors across a range of financial measures, including revenue growth and cost management. But more than engagement is expertise. A 2005 survey by Ernst & Young, ExecuNet, and the Human Capital Institute found that 63% of HR professionals believe the pending retirements of older baby boomers could lead to a critical brain drain of know-how within their organizations. Companies need older people to stick around. The motivations for working longer are mixed. The need for money is not unimportant, but some surveys find that enjoyment is a bigger reason than need. AARP found in both 1998 and 2003 that a bigger plurality of boomers said they would work in retirement mainly for enjoyment as opposed to mainly for income. The Rutgers University survey found the very same pattern. But even if they're working longer just for the money, older people provide unique contributions. It's in everyone's interest to see to it that older workers are able to stay actively involved. This will take many more changes and accommodations to make this truly viable. But failing to do so because it would only help older workers is a prejudice that bites back. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.